President Trump might not like the idea of sitting down for an interview with special counsel Robert Mueller, but there's a chance he could be forced to do so.
John Dowd has been talking with the Associated Press. He's the president's former lawyer who resigned amid discussions of whether a president widely noted for not telling the truth should talk with investigators.
Dowd says if Trump finally declines to talk, prosecutors have discussed a subpoena. The pressure of the investigation has prompted a conflict with Congress. The Washington Post reports that some House Republicans who are close to the president have talked about impeaching Rod Rosenstein.
He's the deputy attorney general who is overseeing the Russia investigation. And to all of this, Rosenstein responded yesterday.
Now, there have been people who have been making threats privately and publicly against me for quite some time. And I think they should understand by now the Department of Justice is not going to be extorted.
Not going to be extorted. Rosenstein speaking at a public event in Washington.
All right. With us in the studio now, NPR's Scott Detrow. Hey, Scott.
Good morning.
All right. This threat against Rosenstein is coming from the House Freedom Caucus. Why do they want Rosenstein out?
A couple different reasons. This is part of a long back and forth about information the Department of Justice has and has not turned over to Congress about this investigation. But more broadly, it's the fact that, like President Trump, many of his House conservative allies think this investigation is, as Trump often calls it, a witch hunt. And as the man with the final approval over the investigation, Rosenstein has become a focal point of all this anger. Remember, this is a draft that comes from the Freedom Caucus, the Tea Party wing of the House Republican Conference. It's not coming from leadership, but I think it says a lot about where the feelings of many House Republicans are on this.
So this is a man, Rod Rosenstein. He's a prosecutor. He's careful with his words. He knows the weight of them. And he seems to be saying to lawmakers, hey, you want to try to fire me? Go for it.
Yeah. And I think that's pretty consistent with not just his actions, but with the Department of Justice, the investigation as a whole. You know, President Trump has been railing on Attorney General Jeff Sessions, on Rosenstein, increasingly on Robert Mueller, the special counsel. And yet the investigation not only continues, it seems to have picked up speed in recent weeks. So, again, I would not expect a vote on this impeachment article anytime soon. Paul Ryan and other Republican leaders have continually said that they support Mueller. They support the investigation going forward. But at a time when there are so many questions about will Congress act to protect the Mueller investigation, there was that measure in the Senate Judiciary Committee. I think it shows a lot of Republicans would actually much rather do the opposite and end it as if they can.
And lastly, we've got this news about the president possibly getting subpoenaed. What do you make of this?
This is from a Washington Post report. It fits into a broader pattern, both that we know from public statements and also from a lot of different reports, that there's been an ongoing back and forth between President Trump's legal team and the Mueller investigation about any sort of way that they can have a conversation with President Trump, be it an interview or a grand jury appearance, to get his side of the story.
It's going to happen one way or the other, it sounds like.
They're pushing for it, yeah.
Well, that's a reminder here, even though there's a polite negotiation because it is the president of the United States, ultimately, it's not a choice for the president. If the prosecutors insist, they can insist. They can issue a subpoena in this case.
And at least if you volunteer, you have more control. You can have your own lawyer in the room, et cetera. All right, we'll see what happens there. NPR Scott Detrow for us this morning. Thanks so much, Scott.
Thank you.
The U.S. military this week shut down its Coalition Command Center for ground operations in Iraq.
Yeah, the U.S. says this move marks the end of major combat operations against ISIS, although about 5,000 American troops do remain in Iraq.
NPR's Dana Raff sat down with the commander of Coalition Ground Forces, U.S. Army Major General Walter Piott. She joins us now from Baghdad. Hey, Jane.
Hi there.
So the U.S. has said it wants to keep some troops in Iraq, even though they're closing this center for ground combat. If the battle against ISIS is essentially over there, what are these troops who are staying behind, what are they going to be doing?
Well, according to General Piott, instead of backing up the Iraqis in active combat as they've been doing, the U.S. military is going to turn to kind of a more focused security help, including quite a lot of specialized training. Here's how the general puts it.
We're really in two different categories. One, we're co-located where we're providing assistance to security operations, and we're also building what we call building partner capacity, really training, whether it's training for intelligence, training for, you know, brigade maneuvers, police forces, individual training, air force training, air controller training.
And that could leave still a few thousand U.S. troops in the country. So General Pyatt took me into the Joint Operations Command Center in Baghdad. It's a room filled with giant screens for surveillance feeds, and there are rows of desks with U.S. and coalition and Iraqi officers. One of the Iraqi officers came over to show him quite proudly footage from their latest Iraqi strike. They were using American F-16 fighter jets, and they had hit ISIS tunnels, actually, in mountains in north-central Iraq.
ISIS tunnel. So that means ISIS isn't totally gone.
Not totally, no. So military commanders say that they've been driven out of maybe 98% of Iraqi territory. So that's pretty good, considering that 4 years ago they controlled a third of the country. But that 2% is still worrying. Here's General Pyatt again.
ISIS remains. I mean, yeah, it's hard to measure how and where, because it's the ideology of ISIS, too, and that has to be done. I mean, wars don't end in peace, and the fighting, winning the fight sometimes can be a lot easier than winning the peace. So this is a very delicate time.
And by that, he means that Iraqis need jobs. They need to see their cities reconstructed, because this has never really been just a military fight. And what makes it more complicated, even, is that there are Iraqi elections this month. So part of how much of a U.S. presence there is here going forward will be up to whatever new government is in place here.
And securing the peace is going to be dependent on Iraqi security forces. I mean, the U.S. spent billions of dollars training these same people, these same Iraqi security forces, after it disbanded the army back in 2003, after it toppled Saddam. So what is the state of Iraqi forces right now?
Well, a lot better than 4 years ago when they actually collapsed entire divisions. They've proved now, according to U.S. military commanders, that they're willing to fight. They have taken literally thousands of casualties in defeating ISIS. So they need to recruit new forces and continue training. But the key is that commanders here, the American ones, believe that after those very painful years, Iraqis are now ready to take over their own security again.
NPR's Jane Arraf from Baghdad. Thanks so much, Jane.
Thank you.
A UN Security Council delegation is just back from a visit to Bangladesh and Myanmar.
They were working on a plan for how to repatriate the nearly 700,000 Rohingya Muslims who fled to Bangladesh last year after a Myanmar military crackdown that some U.S. and U.N. officials call ethnic cleansing.
All right, we've got reporter Michael Sullivan on the line, who's been covering this issue from both Bangladesh and his base in Thailand. Michael, what can you tell us about this visit by U.N. officials? Who'd they meet with? How'd these meetings go?
It began in the refugee camps in Bangladesh, where they heard awful stories from the Rohingya there. Then they met with Bangladesh's Prime Minister, Sheikh Hasina, who implored the delegation to get Myanmar to take back what she called its citizens. But Myanmar, of course, doesn't recognize the vast majority of Rohingya as citizens, and that's really the problem, yeah? Then the delegation left for Myanmar to meet with Aung San Suu Kyi and the Commander-in-Chief of the military.
Aung San Suu Kyi has been criticized for not speaking out enough on behalf of the Rohingya. I mean, what happened at the end of all of this? I mean, did the delegation reach some kind of conclusion about what should be done here?
Not really. I mean, they said that the refugees should be allowed to return safely without conditions. The Security Council's British representative, Karen Pierce, also said it was time to collect evidence either by the Burmese themselves or by the international community, perhaps even the International Criminal Court. Human rights groups have been saying all along that what the military did to the Rohingya amounts to crimes against humanity, but there was no stick from the delegation. It did take a quick helicopter visit to Rakhine State, Rachel, where the violence began, but it seemed like it was a dog and pony show, really. State television showing the delegation visiting some villages, a transit center, a reception camp where the Rohingya, who do return if they have valid ID, will be housed initially. But the delegates could also see some of the Rohingya villages that had been bulldozed by the military after the violence.
Huh. So I would imagine the government in Myanmar doesn't want to be cast as a complete pariah in the world. What leverage, if any, does the UN have to change this situation? I mean, are there any consequences for the Myanmar military's violence against the Rohingya?
I don't think there's any consequences yet. I think on the Myanmar side, this was purely a PR exercise, a way of showing that they're trying to play nice after repeatedly stonewalling the UN in the past, a UN that's been clamoring for unfettered access to Rakhine State for more than a year and hasn't gotten it, and for international aid groups to be allowed to resume their activities there unfettered as well. That hasn't happened either. And even if a team was allowed, Rachel, in to collect evidence, A lot of it's probably gone already. All this happened 8 months ago, and many of the Rohingya villages burned to the ground during the violence have been literally bulldozed away.
So in the meantime, you still have tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Rohingya in these refugee camps waiting.
Yes, and the whole idea of these refugees returning, I don't see that happening either. A few maybe, but it's been called ethnic cleansing for a reason, right, Rachel? The government's gotten what it wanted. Most of the Rohingya have fled. Why would Myanmar take them back? But that doesn't mean the military shouldn't be held accountable.
Reporter Michael Sullivan for us this morning. Michael, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Rachel.